This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us this afternoon to discuss the stories and events affecting the tri-state are Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederick, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Education reporter Bob Driehaus, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. You can join the conversation this afternoon at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Jay, Chris, Bob, good to see everybody this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Good afternoon.
Bob, let's start by talking some educational stuff here. Cincinnati Public Schools is going to be going to the voters to ask for a levy increase. So how much are they asking for, and why are they asking for it?
So they're asking for $48 million over 5 years. There's a big new expansion in this levy into preschool. $15 million would be a year would be dedicated to expanding public and private preschool in the district. And I should correct myself. It's $48 million a year.
$48 million
for
a year
years.
Over five,
yeah,
for a five-year period.
Yep.
What does this amount to millage-wise? What are they asking for?
They're actually not doing it as millage. It's an emergency levy so that they can make sure that they get that exact amount of money for complicated reasons.
Yeah. How much of a deficit are they facing if they don't ask for this money? What are they saying about that?
They are looking at a deficit of over $50 million a year in a couple years, absent some serious spending cuts.
Mm-hmm. So that's before any spending cuts. It's $50 million a year.
That's right. Yeah. And they do have some that they're projecting to add. But at this point, they're facing a big crunch if they don't get this levy passed.
And how much is being earmarked for preschool? You said $15 million?
Mm-hmm.
That's each year?
That's right.
Okay. Chris, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, it's a whopper of a tax increase. I think I know what Bob said about the millage, but I think, if I'm not wrong, please correct me if I am, Bob, that it's about the equivalent of 8 mils.
I think that's about right.
Yeah, and that makes it a $300 a year tax increase for people with a $100,000 home. That's a lot of money, and that's going to be a tough lift, particularly considering city voters rejected a very, very small millage increase for the parks last year. That was about, I think, one mil.
Yeah. 1 mil.
This is, you know, eight times that. So, you know, I think they have a very uphill battle. One interesting thing I think about this is that for a long time, the preschool promise, which is kind of merged with the CPS levy here, they had talked about doing an income tax increase at the city level to fund their program. And so they've combined this together with the CPS's needs. And, I don't think a lot of people know it because they're, used to paying their school taxes through their property taxes. But CPS could have sought an income tax. And really, the price tag on that, if they had tried to do this through an income tax, you know, the average the person making the median income in Cincinnati is about $56,000. They would have only ended up paying about $145 extra in taxes a year. So it's interesting the choice they made to go with the property tax rather than the income tax, because of course the income tax comes from a wider array of people who work in the city, not just people who live in the city.
And I think, Chris, haven't they done some polling for Preschool Promise, and basically they presented three alternatives to voters: the city's earnings tax increase, a property tax increase, and I believe a sales tax increase.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the one that had the most support was for the increase in the city's earnings tax.
That's right. And it kind of makes sense because you're paying less as a city resident. You get all the benefit without having to pay the full cost. And the folks from outside of the city or CPS who would be ponying up through the payroll tax, they don't get a say in that vote. So, that's a lot of that. And I would say, too, about the earnings tax, there was definitely desire on the part of Preschool Promise to go that route because they thought it would be successful. There was a lot of pushback from the business community, and that's why we've ended up with this this compromise.
Bob, can you did the business community ever go into why they really opposed an income tax?
Yeah, they feel strongly. I talked to the CBC director Gary Lindgren about this, and he said a couple things. If you raise it, It hurts the competitiveness of downtown businesses. When they're asking people to come work downtown, they're already looking at paying for a lot of parking. And so even though it's a relatively small tax increase in someone's paycheck, they do see it as a real disincentive for getting quality workers. And the second thing is just the slippery slope theory that it's been a lot of years since they've raised the earnings tax, and they're worried that once we do it for this, well, then how come we don't do it for this priority, et cetera.
And I know I have to be careful. I'm supposed to be answering questions instead of asking them.
But we're all allowed to ask questions of each other.
Actually, I think that's the first time I've heard that it was an emergency levy, and that carries different connotations from what kind of school levies have been on the ballot in the past, I think. And and normally there's a rollback. The longer a levy goes, the less that it could add up on your property. But with an emergency levy, it's guaranteed to bring in $48 million a year no matter what happens to property values.
That's right, yeah.
So you could pay 8 mils this year and then turn around and it may go up to 9 mils the next year to bring in that same amount of money.
Yeah, and I guess if property values rise, you'd be paying less millage too, right?
But they're always guaranteed that fixed amount of $48 million.
And that's exactly why they went that route.
The other thing, Bob, is, I mean, hasn't there been like a debate for a number of years since the Ohio Supreme Court ruled on this that property taxes aren't necessarily the way schools should be funded anyway?
Yeah, definitely. We're still out of compliance with the Supreme Court, which is a whole other thing.
I have to say I'm a little skeptical of the reason not to go for an income tax here. If they had raised the income tax, it would have had to go from about 2.1% to about 2.36%. In Cleveland, they're looking at raising it to 2.5. I'm really skeptical of the reason of there. I feel like it's an ideological thing.
Isn't Columbus 2.5 that was raised a few years ago?
I believe Columbus is higher than ours is and would be if they had switched this to an income tax instead of a property tax.
What does this do to preschool there? They're going to get $15 million. How much had they sought? And I think then it scales back the number of kids that they would actually have available be available for the program.
Yeah, it's a great question, and we don't know the whole answer to it. I think they were hoping to get something over $20 million. It's a moving target because it depends on how much you're subsidizing middle class families, for example, where the cutoff for low income folks is for fully subsidizing them. But $15 million, they are telling me that they're confident that they're going to be able to fully fund everyone whose income is 200% the federal poverty level and below, and then some money left over for folks who or earn more than that, but they don't have the details yet to confirm that.
And I assume it's no accident that they're going to put it on this fall with the presidential election because they want a higher turnout for the levy.
I think so. I looked I got the numbers for levies back to 83, and I looked at each presidential year levy, and they all passed, with the exception one year they had one with a renewal and an addition. The renewal passed, the addition did not. But usually the voters who come out for presidential elections, it seems, are supportive of the school levies.
Bob, what's the preschool promise? Tell us about that.
So that's a coalition of folks. United Way, Strive Partnership did a lot with that, and some other partners. The Amos Project, they're all big advocates as sort of a social justice issue. If you can get kids ready for kindergarten through quality preschool, the theory goes, they're going to have a lot more success at learning to read at grade level by third grade. And if you're reading at third grade level in third grade, you're ready to learn, read to learn rather than learn to read, and you have statistically a much higher success rate at graduating high school and all the good things that flow from that. So Preschool Promise is a coalition of folks who was dedicated to trying to make preschool universally affordable, if not free, in CPS, and ideally for them, the county, which is a goal that they haven't reached yet.
One other thing about this is that I think part of this is that the Preschool Promise Coalition, you know, I think that they also reckon in the school district, really, I think they recognize that they want to see some changes in the way the state formula works down the road, that this is not going to be some cure-all levy. There's kind of an odd phenomenon where CPS is actually more successful. It's getting more students to go to CPS schools, which is kind of a change from past trends. Yet they don't really get the most bang for their buck in terms of state funding once they attract more students to the school district. And I think that they want to go to Columbus and try to get that fixed. And I know that the business community, you know, backs them in doing that.
That's so, Bob, do we have any idea how many kids this would affect? How many kids this would give more access to preschool?
Well, we don't know yet until they come out with exactly what that pays for. But it's thousands, less than 10,000, but a lot of folks.
Have they talked anything yet about their campaign organization, how they're going to get this, how they're going to sell their message to voters?
Yeah, I've asked. They've been pretty mum on that so far, but I'm sure they'll. I heard that Jens Suttmoller was involved in the levy, but I don't know how much money or how they'll do it.
Jens has run a number of school campaigns, and he also ran the unsuccessful campaign of former mayor Roxanne Qualls in 2013. You know, I think with the business community signing off on this property tax, you're going to see them pony up some money, and that may be the reason that we see a property tax rather than income tax. I think that's a factor in it. So, you know, and it'll be interesting to see how this turns out, because the business community's record in terms of passing tax increases is not particularly great.
Yeah. Yeah, you certainly have a lot of parties from a broad spectrum supporting this, with Amos Project, which is a coalition of churches and synagogues and, I believe, mosques, and which, you know, is more on the left-leaning side of things in the business community. So that's a good start for the levy, but it is a lot of money for taxpayers to pony up.
You got any sense of whether it's going to pass or not?
I'm working on it. I couldn't really say at this point. Yeah. It's such a crazy volatile election year. Like, who knows who's going to turn out in November? Is Trump going to keep surprising us and draw in a bunch of new voters who don't like public education or
don't like taxes
or don't like, right? Yeah. Yeah. Or supportive of public education. Or will, you know, it be a Hillary landslide? There are a lot of factors that we don't know yet.
So think Clifton. I mean, it's one neighborhood in the city, but they are embroiled in a dispute over the Clifton Cultural Arts Center, which CPS is looking at as a site for a school. I live in Clifton. There are some unhappy people there. I don't have kids or anybody in the district or anything, but just some things you hear the neighborhood. They're not real happy with CPS right now, and their support, I think, is going to be essential to pass this thing.
Yeah, that's true.
Bob, tell us a little bit more about the argument that's going on between CPS and Clifton.
Yeah, so there are several issues that intertwine. The biggest contention right now is the fate of the Clifton Cultural Arts Center, which is the old Clifton public school building. It is now run by the Arts Center, and they've got a lot of community activities that go on in their arts and recreation. And CPS, looking to alleviate overcrowding at Fairview Clifton German Language School, which is literally across the street, they're looking to take over parts of the art center. The negotiations have not gone well over releasing that from the art center, and it's now on the table that CPS would terminate its lease and take back that whole building, which is setting up a lot of creating a lot of angst in the community. Those negotiations are ongoing, and then the other element is who gets in, who is prioritized to get into Fairview Clifton German, and that's been roiled up in a lot of different ways. And then the last element is they're talking about, well, if there's this much demand for quality public education in Clifton, they're talking about reopening a neighborhood school in the neighborhood, serving Clifton, uptown neighborhoods, and Spring Grove Village. And right now, CPS says if that's going to happen, it's going to be in the Cultural Arts Center building.
So it sounds like this argument could be going on for some time.
Yeah.
I think they probably want to get it figured out before November.
And as if the school board and the residents were, I think city council weighed in with a resolution saying basically work it out.
Yeah.
Work it out or else. We will continue our conversation. You can join us 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, along with Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederich, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Education reporter Bob Driehaus, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Now, Mayor Cranley has come out with some budget proposals and his version of the budget. And one of the things he's talking about doing is buying Wasson Way for $12 million. Now, Jay, what is Wasson Way? What's it going to be used for?
Well, Wasson Way is an unused railroad line that runs through, I think it touches about nine city neighborhoods. And it runs from Victory Parkway near the Xavier University campus. And it would eventually tie into the Little Miami Bike Trail out in Newtown. And last summer, the city negotiated with the railroad that owns Wasson Way for an option to purchase, and that option expires at the end of July of this year. And then if they want to extend it, I think it's $500,000 they have to pay.
Half, yeah.
It's another $500,000 to extend it for another year. So basically, Mayor Cranley is saying, let's go ahead and complete the purchase, and that's why he set aside $12 million in his budget revisions to make the purchase. Now, they actually
is it a done deal, Jay?
It sounds like it. I never say anything is a done deal. Even sometimes after they vote, I question whether it's a done deal. But I think he has council support to make this happen. I know one member is going to vote against it, but I think he's got the support to make it happen.
Yeah, the mayor was kind of a veritable Cranley Clause this week. He had all kinds of projects to hand out and to really propose. I mean, the way this works is he's proposed changes in the budget that would fund these projects, and so he'll send that to council, and council will, either vote up or down on him. It sounds like it'll all be in one budget, though, so unless they find five votes to take any of these out, it seems like they're all going to be in.
I think he has promised, now, unless he changes his mind, he has promised individual votes on each one of them. So I think you're probably going to see some will vote for Wasson Way. Some may vote against. I know that another one on the same page in front of me says there's $4 million for a project in Madisonville. So it may not be the same vote total on all.
That's interesting. So he's going to do a separate vote on each one.
That's what some of our reporting indicated, that there were going to be separate ordinances on each one.
Who's going to vote against Wasson Way?
Kevin Flynn told me that he was not for it because he didn't think the city could afford it.
Well, that's the other question, Jay. So you have the money to buy it. But what about the money? What about the money to build it? That's the next question.
I think they have enough grant funding to maybe build the first phase, and it's going to be done in several phases. It's not going to be done at once. I think it was five or six phases. They have enough money to do the first phase, and then as they get grant funding, and actually they're seeking donations through a nonprofit. As they get donations and grant funding, then they'll complete different phases.
They have a little bit of money to do. I don't know if it's even the whole first phase. I think this is something where the big hurdle was getting control of the railroad, and now they have it. So,
even that's not the final hurdle because they still have to have it decommissioned.
Right. There's some bureaucracy to go through.
Right. In the federal government's eyes, it's still a railroad. So they have to have it decommissioned as a railroad before they can start tearing up the tracks and put in this bike and hike trail.
So I guess it's fair to say at this point we don't know when the work will actually get underway.
They're anticipating by their own press release that phase one could start sometime next year.
Right. I think it was next summer. Yeah.
And I think the first phase near the Xavier campus?
It is, yeah. And I think it runs kind of towards Madison Road going east. So, and this is a project that can be funded over a number of budget years through the capital budget and keep building on it. It's really impressive that they found the funding. It's actually kind of interesting how they managed to fund all these projects. They're taking a $10 million tax credit that they shared with the railroad that owns Wasson Way today, or will be the former owner, I guess, Norfolk Southern, and so they're taking the $10 million from that and putting it into the purchase of this railroad. Then they had another $25 million. The mayor told me from the Blue Ash Airport sale a number of years ago. They refinanced some streetcar bonds that were backed by that purchase. And so the money, the $25 million they used for the streetcar, that became freed up and available, and so that's what he's using to fund the rest of these projects, which include, you know, a grocery store and rehab of Avondale Town Center. Actually, they're going to tear it completely down and build it anew. A mixed-use project in Madisonville in their business district. Wasson Way, of course. Affordable housing in Over the Rhine. A mixed-use project in College Hill Station, which is where they used to have a Kroger. So there's all these projects that have kind of been on the city's drawing boards. Most of them, or many of them, I guess, were initiated by Mayor Mark Mallory.
And yeah, so, the Madisonville plan, I think, has been around since Mayor Mallory.
Yeah, so you know, Cranley has now found, you know, some money to pay for these things.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I've watched a lot of budgets, and I think this started in 2001 with the Strong Mayor, where the manager drafts the budget, gives it to the mayor. The mayor has 14 days to review it, and then it goes to council. But in all that time, I don't know that I've ever seen so much money added to the budget. There's tinkering with a few million dollars,
right?
But I don't know that I've ever seen $35 million added.
This is a ton of money.
This is a lot of money.
This is a big, you know, and it makes total sense. We're going into an election year next year. The mayor's going to be up for re-election. So are the council members. So, you know, and the mayor, one thing he hammered home in 2013 was he was going to be the neighborhood's mayor. And since then, you know, he could certainly point to projects he's done, but never this big push that we're seeing this year. So it makes total sense. I think that his potential opponent accused him in the Inquirer of being political in terms of the way these projects were doled out in today's Inquirer. And, you know, I think there's some truth to that. But at the same time, these are projects that have been in the communities and they've been vetted and the communities want them. So.
And there was that same article, I think, also said that, and that could be something that we'll hear about, that these negotiations were done with these neighborhood groups behind closed doors,
right,
without any public input. And there are going to be other neighborhoods saying, you know, where's my project? Where's my funding?
Well, what about basic infrastructure needs? I mean,
well, that's part of the capital acceleration plan, and there's going to be some, and I don't know that they want this, they haven't highlighted this yet, but there's probably going to be some bad news on the capital acceleration plan, because they had promised to basically pave 150 lane miles of roads each year under the capital acceleration plan, except blacktop costs have skyrocketed. And so now what they anticipated doing, 150, I'm told, may be closer to 110, maybe best case 120, because they just can't afford, with the skyrocketing expenses, to do 150 lane miles a year.
I mean, that was the biggest basic services, basic capital maintenance, like the roads. That was the centerpiece of last year's budget. So, you know, he's got a whole lot that he can talk about as he goes to run for re-election next year.
Is the project around Westwood Town Hall included in this too? The putting
yep.
in a yeah, I thought
Westwood Square. Yep, no, yep. We've got $4 million. And if that goes through, it says that the work on it could actually begin in July of this year.
Hmm. So there was a four neighborhood revitalization?
Actually, I think there are more than that, because you've got Wasson Way and Madisonville, Westwood Square, College Hill Station, West Price Hill, Bond Hill, Roselawn, Avondale, and then the couple of projects that Chris mentioned in downtown over the Rhine project.
At least, and it depends on how you count them. I mean, there's at least 9 or 10 here. You know, one of the really interesting ones I thought was that he was going to devote, I think it was $4 million, maybe to, or maybe it was two. Either way, it was several million dollars to the Port Authority and a new kind of community development organization in Bond Hill, and they would basically have.
$3.2 million.
$3.2 million. Split the difference. There we go. they would basically have 50-50 ownership over this money and have to, you know, collaborate and consent to, you know, to spend it. And one of the people at the press conference was Reverend Damon Lynch III, who, you know, he was an early supporter of the mayor's parks levy, and then when he and his church figured out that they would have to basically sell their church and turn it over to the city to build the recreation and urban campground that was there, that was something they ended up balking at, and that was not a great moment in the campaign for the parks levy. So Reverend Lynch was front and center this week as this new initiative was announced. So it kind of looked to me like some fence mending had been done there.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. And Justin in Lebanon joins us now. Hi, Justin.
How's it going?
Good, thanks.
Hey, I have a couple questions for you guys. My wife works in Cincinnati as a practitioner at Children's, so we pay income tax, you know, to the city. And also, so with all this talk about taxes going up on income or profit, is that going to make our tax go higher there? And then the second question is for a couple like me and my wife, our kids are going to go to private school. And so when it goes to property tax, are we ever going to see a break for folks that want to put our kids in their private school?
Under the CPS levy, your property taxes would not go up if you live in Lebanon, no.
And earnings taxes aren't touched.
We were just talking about earnings tax as a potential alternative to the property tax that they opted not to go with.
That's right, Justin. That was something that had been under discussion that they might do that, but they opted to go the property tax direction.
And as far as would you get help with preschool, not from this. This is just for Cincinnati Public Schools District, which is basically the city of Cincinnati and a few other geographical areas, but not Lebanon.
Again, 513-419-7100 to join us. You can also email talk@wvxu.org. And Malcolm in Clifton is joining us now. Hi, Malcolm.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm with the Clifton Town Meeting Community Council. I wanted to comment on the issue of the neighborhood school and the CCAC arts facility. All three community councils affected by this proposed neighborhood school have come together and are united in asking the school board to engage with us in a community process to explore the possibility of a neighborhood school, what its program would be, and in the meantime, to hold off terminating the CCAC lease. We've tried very hard to engage with the public school system to address these issues, but have not been able to get them on board. So we're taking the initiative now, and we are actually beginning to plan our own community engagement process, and we invite the public schools to the table to join us. Whether they join us or not, we're going to move forward and work on getting a workable plan for the three neighborhoods to give every child a quality seat to education. And that's our goal for the whole city, is that every child should be entitled to a secure seat in a quality school, not be subject to levy or to levy, certainly subject to levies, not be subject to a lottery or other unknowns. So my question is, and all this is, how do you engage the public schools in a dialogue of this kind? Has anybody else done it successfully that you know of? What do you think can be done?
Bob?
You're the education expert, Bob.
Right.
Is this where we take next question?
Right. Thanks for the call, Malcolm. Malcolm has been a great contributor, actually, to a story that I wrote recently. I think it takes some neighborhood activism to make sure that your voices are heard, and I think Clifton has that in abundance. So, especially in a levy year, it's a good question, Malcolm. I don't know specifically if other communities have sort of pulled along their district to successfully alter the plan, but I'm sure Clifton is going to. If any neighborhood could do it, it's Clifton, and it's very involved parents.
Malcolm, what's the if you don't? Oh, okay.
Bob, question for you. You were mentioning they're negotiating on this issue. How much negotiating is the question? I mean, are they constantly going back and forth, or is it just, well, when we feel like talking to you, we'll talk to you? Or what's the status of it?
It's pretty active, actually. The school board has met repeatedly with different groups, sometimes in a collection of groups, sometimes individually. But there's Clifton Town Meeting, which represents the neighborhood. The CCAC has its own board. The LSMDC, which is the sort of local governing organization over Fairview Clifton, they've all been at the table with board members and with CPS administrators. So they're working. They're all working at it. They just haven't found the common ground that they need yet.
Moving on to something else, Jay, there's been the debate over tearing down the former Denison Hotel downtown. Now, Something happened this week. What was that? Something happened. Nothing.
Something happened this week. Nothing. And again, Chris can give you the nuts and bolts. I'll give you the highlights of what was supposed to happen this week and didn't. The city has a historic conservation board, and the owner of the building, Columbia REI, made an application to demolish the former Denison Hotel, and the Historic Conservation Board is the one that will approve that. So they had a hearing yesterday where they were supposed to make a decision on yes, you can demolish it.
Or no, you can't.
No, you can't demolish it. Well, each side was
now,
given –
Now, is this building on the historic registry list or
– I don't know if
– Not on the registry list. It's a contributing building to the historic district.
Yeah, okay.
So historic enough but not uber historic.
So the meeting started yesterday at 1 o'clock. The city's urban conservator has issued a report in which she said it should not be torn down. She presented her report, and then each side was going to be given 30 minutes to present their arguments. Well, the applicant side ended up taking three hours.
At least, well, a little bit more even. Yeah.
And there are seven members on the Historic Conservation Board. Two have recused themselves, so they can't hear this case, so that left five. One of the five needed to leave yesterday afternoon to go teach a class in Blue Ash at 6 o'clock, and since the applicant had been given 3 hours to present their case, they thought that it was probably going to take 3 hours for the opponents to present their case. So at first they were going to continue the hearing with just four people, and then she would read the testimony and they'd take a vote later. All of the attorneys said, no, you need to be here and listen to all the testimony, all the cross-examination. So then Hurley went into a closed session and came back out and said, we're going to adjourn. And when we come back, the opponents will present their case. They'll hear from the public, and then maybe they'll vote. But we, unless it's happened recently, I don't think they've set that new date yet.
So yeah. Still nothing has happened.
So nothing has happened.
It would have to be in our email right now. This was kind of a I'd never really witnessed one of these, or at least a full-scale one of these hearings before. It's really kind of like the building is on trial for its life in a way. Each lawyer has witnesses that they bring up, and the other lawyer gets to cross-examine them. So we're looking at the proponents of keeping the building the next time they reconvene this hearing.
What are the owner's plans for this?
Well, they want to tear it down.
They want to tear it down and
eventually someday put either a corporate headquarters there. And this is a massive parking lot that they have near the Denison. So it could fit a very big structure. Or in the alternative, if they can't find a corporate headquarters or somebody to take a tenancy there, then they would probably put some residential buildings there as well.
But it sounds like if they do get to tear it down, it'll just be vacant for a long time.
Yeah, they've talked about putting some landscaping there to make it look fine. I mean, it doesn't really add that many parking spaces to the site.
I think one thing we were told yesterday, they can't even put parking spaces there, I believe.
They would have to get a variance for that, which the opponents of demolition say they're going to go try to do, and the people who own the building, which is Columbia REI, the development arm of the Joseph Otto family, they say they're not going to try to put a parking lot there.
So what do the opponents have to say about this?
You know, the opponents say that this is a historic building designed by Samuel Hannaford, the designer of City Hall and Music Hall, and that it's in a historic district for a reason and it shouldn't be torn down, and that the Josephs bought the building with the intent to demolish it, which is against the city's zoning code. And I think they're going to bring up a number of witnesses to support their case the next time they're here next time they have a hearing.
And the applicant yesterday, that was their argument. All their witnesses, that was that there's not an economically feasible development that they can put into the building to salvage it.
One of the key points of the whole day was that the owners of the building did not study the possibility of receiving federal or state or local tax help for the project, and that therefore their analysis wasn't really worth much. So that was something that they argued over for quite a while.
And this is nowhere. I mean, we're all looking for the next headline that the Historic Conservation Board says it can be demolished.
This is nowhere near that.
This is not the end of it. No. Whichever side loses, I think the next step would be the City Zoning Board of Appeals, and then depending on that outcome, it's going to end up in state court.
Right.
And, depending on how far somebody at City Hall even told me that they thought that was interesting the way that the city staff report was drafted. It was almost like a legal brief, knowing that it's going to end up in court. And they kind of learned some lessons from the
Campbell House
that, you know, that this document is very important.
This is clearly the opening salvo, and you, one thing that's interesting about this, you don't see the preservationists hire a lawyer like Sean Souter very often. He's a kind of a high powered attorney, so they're really going to the mattresses on this.
Are they going to have the money to fight this as far as the Joseph Group is willing to take it?
That is a great question that we should ask them.
Well, and it was just interesting. It was contested from the start. They swore in the witnesses, and one of the witnesses that they did not swear in was the Urban Conservator, and there was some question whether her testimony should be given under oath and if she was subject to cross-examination. And they were arguing over, was there 464 documents? And there are some documents that most of them they agreed to, but there's a few that they – and then they were showing poster boards that were of similar buildings, but was not – it was just –
it was like a court case.
Yeah.
It was like a trial.
And it was interesting.
On that point, you know, one of the things, you know, if the conservation board votes to not allow demolition – the lawsuit, I believe, has to be against the city, so it would be up to the city solicitor to defend it going forward in court. Do you think? Am I right about that, Jay? Do you think? Or?
I think that's the way that the Gamble House.
Yeah. So I'm not sure they have to have deep pockets to have Souter keep going on and on throughout the case. I'm not sure if they have to or if they will, but I think it's a good point we need to look at.
We'll continue our review of the news, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining me this afternoon are Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederick, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Education reporter Bob Driehaus, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Going back to the budget, Jay, people want to get their 2 cents worth in, how do they do that?
Just real quickly, if you're one of the neighborhoods that's here, where's my project, you have a chance to tell council that you want your project. The hearings start next week. The first one is Thursday, June the 2nd at the Oakley Recreation Center on Paxton Avenue. And then Monday, June the 6th, it's at the Reds Urban Baseball Academy on Seymour Avenue. And then the last public hearing is Tuesday, June the 7th at the College Hill Recreation Center on Belmont Avenue.
Okay. Bob, what else have you been covering this week on the education beat?
Yeah. The Northern Kentucky University had to deal with a big state budget cut.
All of Governor Bevin's budget?
He cut higher ed spending to shift some money into the state's woefully underfunded pension system. And the result is that NKU, along with some other factors, they're going to cut about 105 jobs. And also, you know, pare back some other things. And they're even looking at selling WNKU if the price is right.
Yeah, I was wondering if that sale was still on or they're still trying to do it.
Yeah, they're looking at a broker right now to go sell it for them. So they're not very far along in that process.
So I shouldn't write them a check or?
You should always support public radio.
That's right.
I agree.
So Bob, the obviously an impact on NKU, the local part of the Kentucky education system, higher education system. I guess the repercussions, though, are pretty widespread across the state from this.
Yeah. I mean, it's an across-the-board cut in higher education. Gateway is also suffering from this, the Community and Technical College in Northern Kentucky, and, you know, everybody, UK, Louisville, all the other colleges and universities in the state. And this was a year when they were hoping that funding would be boosted because around the country, higher ed funding took a giant hit in 2008 after the 2008 Great Recession. And in the last couple of years, state budget, state revenue has been rising around the country, and just about everyone else has started pumping money back into higher ed, including Ohio, has, I think, 5% increases for the next 2 years. So that's another thing that the Kentucky educators argued unsuccessfully, that they were going to be losing out to the competition from neighboring states for, you know, quality students and quality professors to teach them, when more money was going in their neighbors' budgets and they are cutting.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. And Mark in Loveland joins us now. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
Oh, yeah, I was calling about the debate going on about whether or not to demolish the building in downtown Cincinnati.
The former Denison Hotel. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I was just thinking, couldn't they just strike a deal where they replicate that building or the front of it or save the front of it and find some way to save history but, you know, keep building the city?
So save some vestige of the building.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times they will, and when I say they, I'm talking about developers, a lot of times they'll try to incorporate old buildings into their developments, whether they're historic buildings or whatnot. It didn't sound yesterday like the Joseph family was too interested in incorporating that building into their future plans, and really the city has no way to compel them to do that other than, you know, not allowing them to tear down the building.
Any other thoughts? Okay. Jeannie in downtown joins us as well. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi. Hello?
Go right ahead, Jeannie. You're on.
Okay. I just wanted to give a comment on the school levy. I've always supported all the school levies, and I'm single. I have no children. So I'm all fine for the school levy and maybe the preschool thing, because kids need the preschool. But my thing is, you pass the school levy, then at the end of the year, you hear how abominable the graduation rates are. So my question is, well, does it turn around and do any good? You have another school levy, then you hear about the abominable graduation rates. So it just sounds like a vicious cycle.
Yeah.
That's just my comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeannie. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of work to do with the graduation rates in Cincinnati. I don't have that handy, but I do believe they've been inching up a little bit in recent years. I shouldn't hazard a guess, but I'm going to. I believe the graduation rate is in the high 70s now, which is a lot better than it had been in even like 10 years ago. But that still leaves a lot of kids who aren't graduating. And, you know, there's a lot more to it than money and what teachers and administrators can do to make sure kids are coming to school well-fed, well-cared for, and in a position where they want to graduate. But CPS definitely has some work to do to push those graduation rates higher.
Well, and I think to Jeannie's point, if they're going to get this levy passed, they're going to have to convince voters that, yes, you're getting your money's worth by doing this.
Yeah.
You know, one of the interesting things about CPS is I think it has one of the higher graduation rates of any urban district in the state, and certainly and maybe even the nation. You know, it's just interesting because the district, when you compare it to a suburban district, yeah, it's not a great 70, you know, mid-70s, 80% graduation rate isn't great compared to Lakota or something like that. But these urban public schools face, you know, a host of socioeconomic challenges with the students and the condition that they come in to the school district. You know, so that 70 to 80% figure for graduation is considered pretty good compared to other urban districts in the country.
Yeah, there are eight large urban districts in Ohio, and Cincinnati consistently ranks number one among them. So for the challenges they have, they've been considered a leader in dealing with them. Yeah, I mean, they have a lot of kids who are homeless or chronically, you know, moving from one place to another. There are just so many challenges for a large percentage of the kids who go through CPS.
Jay, we got the official date for the streetcar opening.
We do.
So this is something Jay and I are very and excited
actually,
about.
And actually, I can remember it because it's my oldest niece's birthday. The opening day will be on tentatively, as long as all the inspections
go well. So this is not definite.
This is not definite, but let's say it's pretty certain.
Okay.
But there could be hurdles. But it's September the 9th, and from the sounds of it, it's going to be like a midday ribbon cutting near Washington Park, and so service will start right after that, and then they're planning a weekend full of activities on that first weekend of the streetcars operation.
Now, so what still needs to be done at this point? What do they still have to get past?
There are safety certifications that have to be approved by the Ohio Department of Transportation and the Federal Transit Administration, and they have to sign off that the system is safe. And the only thing that I think is going to be up in the air right now, question-wise, is are folks actually going to have to pay to ride the streetcar that
right,
first
week? I was
going to
ask if it's free that during the opening.
Right now it is not. They're working on finding a sponsor to cover that. I don't – unless it's just happened, they had not secured a sponsor yet. Although I think they're going to get some heavy pushback because what I was told at City Hall, any streetcar system in the country that has opened the first weekend is generally – free. The precedent is that the first weekend is free.
I made the mistake of skipping the Transportation Committee this week, Jay. I don't know if you know the answer to this. How come they couldn't open it the weekend before, the first weekend in September?
From what I'm told, it was a matter of staging with the first weekend was Labor Day weekend
right.
with the Riverfest fireworks. And then the weekend after its official opening is Oktoberfest, which ironically it could open
run close
one weekend
right away.
And then be closed the next weekend. So I think this was – and I think they had to have it running by the 15th to satisfy FTA.
Yeah.
So
what happens if they didn't hit that deadline?
They would just have – they would just have to have a waiver from FTA. But I think with all the things that have gone wrong or gone right, however you look at it with the streetcar, they did not want to be asking FTA for an extension on the opening day.
So let's see, how long ago did the streetcar, when was it first proposed?
Oh
I'm trying to
gosh.
Go how long this has taken to get to this point.
Maybe,
Cranley
maybe 2007.
Was on, I was going to say Cranley, I think, was on council when the first motion, so I was going to say 2007, 2008.
Okay, so the bank still has it beat as far as how long it took to become reality. So,
well, it depends on how far back you go in the banks.
But. That's true. Where you consider the starting point to be with that. There's also been a debate over a plan for making Central Parkway, the bike path, safer. And I think that's being put by council member Chris Smitherman. Tell us about that debate, Jay.
His original motion was that he wanted the protected bicycle lanes taken out from the 16 to 2100 blocks. And I think he saw the handwriting on the wall that he was not going to get support for removing them. So he modified his motion to say that he wanted a solution for the 16 to 2100 block of the Central Parkway protected
bike. So the issue is he wants to make he wants to make it safer.
I think his main concern is the way that the lanes were installed. You have the protected bicycle lane closest to the sidewalk, and then you have the bollards, and then you have parking. And in some places, they shift parking in the morning commute versus the evening commute. And they're apparently in front of the FOP building, which is at 1900 Central Parkway. The vehicle that the FOP had been struck three times since the protected bicycle lane had gone in. A couple of members have been there for meetings and had their vehicles hit. So they were concerned more about the safety of people parking there. They even said, and I don't know if this is true, but they said that some people actually, if they were the last car parked, brought their own traffic cone to set behind their car to indicate that there was a car parked there.
I don't think this is an unusual, and this is what the city's report said. This is not an unusual situation in Cincinnati. I got a friend who lives on Glenway Avenue, and he routinely parks his car outside of his home, and it's a situation where you have shifting times of the day where you can park. His car has been hit three times since living, and totaled three times since living there. So the Central Parkway bike lane is not really a special case, I think, in the city. And that's what the city administration's report said.
And there have already been two reports. And now Mayor Cranley has asked for a third report. Basically, he wants to look at crashes before the bike lanes, crashes after the bike lanes. And he said that'll be a more apples-to-apples comparison.
They don't have any stats as of this point?
The reports have had stats, but I don't think they particularly like the stats. So they want basically, here's what was before, here's what's after they've gone in.
It's a classic Cincinnati debate because it's a change from what something used to be to something different. So,
thanks everybody for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederich, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Education reporter Bob Driehaus, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman.